Threads from the National Tapestry is now on YouTube. Search for Threads from the National Tapestry on YouTube and subscribe to our channel. On the channel, you'll find full podcast episodes paired with relevant photos and maps about each topic. It's another great way to listen to the show. Just search for Threads from the National Tapestry on YouTube and subscribe to our channel.
She was witty, intelligent, and a great conversationalist. Everything that raised the eyebrows of proper Southern women in the mid-19th century. And then she married the man who became the first and only president of the Confederacy, wedded to her fate with him and a doomed nation. Her life was filled with trying times, if you will, locked in a personal civil war, as she struggled to reconcile her societal duties with strong individual beliefs. This is the story of a remarkably resilient woman who served as the Confederacy's First Lady. This is the story of Verena Howell Davis.
The last five letters of history spell story, and that's exactly how history should be taught. Numbers and dates have no soul. Such presentations fall flat, for history is alive and relevant. Welcome to Threads from the National Tapestry, Stories from the American Civil War. This series will feature events and people from that period and will strive to make you feel as if you were there, to show that history is indeed a story.
I have always believed that the 16th President of the United States and the first and only president of the Confederacy would have had much to talk about if ever they might have ever had an afternoon or evening alone in conversation. The two had much in common. So too would have Mary Todd Lincoln and Verena Howell Davis. Both were born into comfort, both great hosts and conversationalists. Both loved politics and men with ambition. Both married a significantly older man. Both lost children before, during, and after the war. As first ladies, both were questioned about their loyalty and harshly criticized by detractors. And both survived their husbands and spent the rest of their days defending and deifying them. History has been tough on Mary Todd Lincoln. Conversely, Verena Howell Davis has been appreciated in a different light. As example of that, Columbia political science and constitutional law professor John W. Burgess said after the war, "If Mr. Lincoln could only have had such a wife." On Sunday, May 7th, 1826, Verena Banks Howell was born on her grandfather's Louisiana plantation. With an olive complexion that showcased her Welsh ancestry, she was the second of 11 born to William Burr and Margaret Kemp Howell Davis. Named for a friend of her mother, Verena, one of seven of the 11 born to William and Margaret that reached adulthood, had prominent maternal ties to the North. Her great-grandfather, Richard Howell, had once been the governor of New Jersey. The young Verena had full, dark, liquid eyes and jet-black, glossy hair. Her mother read many of the literary classics to her. She studied piano and learned French. A tomboy, she, unlike so many females in the South, was tutored. Her tutor for 12 years was Judge George Winchester of Salem, Massachusetts. Next to her grandmother, he was the single greatest force in her early years. A godfather, we believe, may have paid for her to study at a female academy in Philadelphia. There, she thrived in the energy and life of the city of brotherly love. At 17, she returned to Natchez, Mississippi, a plain-featured young woman who, with that olive complexion and slender features, did not make her the ideal Southern belle. For lily-white skin and more rounded was the expected and desirous. When her father lost much in the Panic of 1837, bankruptcy ensued, and to make ends meet, some slaves were sold off. That meant Verena learned to sew and cook, which further damaged her chances of being considered a belle. In truth, the fact her father was financially destitute made her appear as unsuitable. However, there was a way out. Though young, one way she could unburden her father was to consider marriage. Not so unusual, since at that time the average age of marriage for white women was 20. Marriage at that tender age meant the possibility of many children, and thus an adult life of complete devotion to family. Remember, this was a time when women did not vote, were not to question the racial and social values of the time, were not to travel from home without a male escort, and were essentially to give up autonomy for protection found in marriage. To further the demands on women then, courtships were closely chaperoned. That was paramount, since women were expected to marry as virgins. After marriage, adultery destroyed one's reputation. So too could divorce. As to matters in public life, proper women were not to take any interest in politics or to offer opinion. This area in particular was damning for Verena. With a fine education, highly intelligent, and well-read, she was most willing to opine on topics that were so-called reserved for men only. In December of 1843, she received an invitation from one of her father's friends, Joseph Emery Davis, to spend Christmas at his Hurricane Plantation in Warren County, Mississippi. Escorted by her tutor, the two traveled 70 miles north to an expanse that spanned over 5,000 acres and held 226 slaves. It was there, at the garden gate of Hurricane, she, 17, first met Joseph's brother, Jefferson, who had lost his first wife some 8 years earlier, and with that loss had plunged himself into seclusion. That first wife was Sarah Knox Taylor Davis. Only 3 months into their 1835 marriage, she, the daughter of future President Zachary Taylor, passed from malaria at the tender age of 21. Devastated, Jefferson withdrew to Briarfield, 900 acres owned by his brother Joseph Davis, and just down the road from his brother's Hurricane Plantation. There, Jefferson threw himself into work. At 6 feet, with gray eyes, high cheekbones, and curly hair, many thought him quite handsome. It didn't hurt. He had a melodic voice, was well-dressed, and was an accomplished rider, hunter, and marksman. He found her slim, more than average in height, with striking dark hair and olive skin, a broad nose, ample mouth, and full lips. Both were attracted. Still, coyly, the politically devout Whig wrote her mother, "I do not think I shall ever like him as I do his brother, Joe. Would you believe it? He is refined and cultivated, and yet he is a Democrat." Joseph's plantation, Hurricane, awed her. She also was awed by her neighbor, Jefferson, and she talked, walked, and though he was 18 years older than she fell in love. Yes, at 18 years her senior, Jefferson was only 2 years younger than Verena's mother. Perhaps that explains why she lovingly called him Uncle Jeff. On February 26, 1845, they married in Natchez at the Briars. It was a simple wedding. He was 36, she was 18. They planned a honeymoon in New Orleans. And on their way downriver at Bayou Sarah and Locust Grove Plantation, the newlyweds visited Knox Taylor Davis's grave, Jefferson's first wife. Though this at the time was not all that uncommon, it took a while for Verena to get over it. After the honeymoon, which she enjoyed greatly, the two settled in at Briarfield. In time, the 900 acres expanded to 4,000, 2,500 of it tilled, and the remaining 1,500 acres woodland. There, this active-minded, well-educated woman described herself as a loving but useless wife. She had never lived on a true plantation and obviously had never been a plantation mistress. She could not believe how much time was required feeding, clothing, nursing, and tending to the 74 adult slaves found there. From her rearing, she often worked alongside them. Occasionally, she cooked, sewed, and knitted. Like so many marriages, the in-laws became an issue. She learned that Joseph, 24 years older than Jefferson, had paid for some of her husband's education. She also learned that though Jefferson had a free hand at Briarfield, the title was still in Joseph's name. And she learned of Joseph's strong influence in steering Jefferson politically. All this did not sit well, given Verena's strongly independent background and personality. And to make matters worse, Joseph's wife, Eliza, 15 years older than Verena, was not an outlet. Neither were Jefferson's sisters, the youngest of which was 26 years older than she, a generation apart. Then, too, she worried about her husband's stress, his reoccurring bouts of malaria, and a neuralgia that affected his face and eyes. In 1845, in the first year of their marriage, Jefferson won a seat in Congress. She was not yet 20, and definitely not prepared for a three-week trip to Washington City, or as Charles Dickens put it, the City of Magnificent Intentions. There in the city of some 30,000, she relinquished her Whig loyalties. There she was found to be attractive and engaging. Add her gift for making conversation, and she met and befriended many. She met the First Lady, Mrs. Sarah Childress Polk. She became friends with Polk's Secretary of the Treasury, Robert J. Walker, and his wife, Mary. She got to know Montgomery Blair and his wife, Minna. She often chatted with historian George Bancroft, the Vice President George M. Dallas, and had chances to interact or listen to speeches made by Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster, the 6'4" Sam Houston, and two she especially admired, Senators Henry Clay and John C. Calhoun. Here in the nation's capital, she thrived. Unlike home, she, as a female, was invited to speak of politics, and women there could make social calls without an escort. But all that changed when, despite a promise not to, Jefferson volunteered for the Mexican War. As colonel of the 1st Mississippi Rifles, she was disappointed, but understood. After all, as she wrote to her mother, Jefferson was so good to her. And so, dutifully, she returned to Mississippi, where time alone caused her to fall under the depressing and frustrating umbrella of her brother-in-law, Joseph Davis. It was about this time that other scheming in-laws told her that Jefferson had to rely on Joseph's bounty. She also learned that Joseph allowed Jefferson to will Briarfield to Verena, but only for her lifetime. She would not be allowed to will the property to any of her own. Then came word that Joseph had mandated that his widowed sister, Amanda Bradford, and her 7 children would be moving in with her at Briarfield. Things became so troubling that she wrote Jefferson about being quite sick. Worried, he finagled a 60-day leave, and upon his return found her illness was actually sick of being around Joseph Davis and his family, and sick of their talk of Jefferson's dependence on his older brother. Concerned but committed, he returned to Mexico, where in February of 1847 he was painfully wounded at the Battle of Buena Vista. He came home, though, a national hero in June of that same year. His wound required him to use crutches for 2 years, and full recovery did not come until 3 more years passed. In August of 47, despite his disability, the state Democratic Party selected him to fill a senatorial vacancy, and he was sworn in on December the 6th. This time, she did not accompany him to Washington City. It bothered her, for he returned to the city where she thrived. Verena was left behind to deal with in-laws, with inheritance issues, the Bradfords moving in, and Joseph's dominance. Their marriage suffered, and it didn't help that Jefferson was not sympathetic to her concerns. His letters to her during this time clearly show he did not see marriage as a partnership. By the summer of 1848, things were a little better, and she considered divorce, but she knew that could well bring a lifelong stigma. After nearly 3 stormy years, she finally capitulated. She accepted her station and situation. And so in December of 1849, Verena was allowed to return to Washington City. In return for yielding to Jefferson's wishes, she renewed old friendships, made new ones, and flourished in her self-admitted urban personality and interests. As to her capitulation, she wrote her parents that she was now, as she put it, a good girl. Though back in her element, the nation wrestled with the issue of slavery and what to do with it in the territory won from Mexico. Jefferson was adamantly opposed to any sort of compromise on the institution. Despite his opposition, the Compromise of 1850 was passed. It was enough to disgust him with politics, but not enough, however, to run for governor of Mississippi. He resigned his seat in the United States Senate and returned to Mississippi to run on an anti-compromise platform. But he lost. He lost to Henry Foote by some 999 votes, who gloated over his win in part because he despised both Joseph and Jefferson Davis. Jefferson and Verena returned to Briarfield to concentrate on plantation life. It paid off, for during the decade of the 1850s, he grossed some $35,000 to $40,000 a year, and to handle the expanding estate, more slaves were purchased, a total of 113 by 1860. That number placed him in the top 6% of slaveholders in the Magnolia State. And so, from September 1851 to March 1853, Verena was mistress of Briarfield. It would be the longest continuous period of residence for both. As mistress, Verena practiced maternalism with her slaves. It is interesting to note that in her letters, she always used the word Negro rather than the far more degrading term. Though she did not agree with the prevailing thought that slaves were subhuman, she did accept the status quo of their condition. While her husband campaigned about Mississippi for Democratic presidential candidate Franklin Pierce, Verena gave birth to a son July 30th, 1852. Since there had been a miscarriage 2 years earlier, the baby boy, Samuel Emery Davis, named for Jefferson's father, sent the two into euphoria. It is interesting to note that Verena's mother had a son who, amazingly, was not much older than Sam. Life always seems to be yin-yang, and with the successful birth of their first child, Jefferson had a massive falling out with his surrogate father, older brother Joseph. It was so severe that the two considered a test of honor, a duel. They did not speak to one another for 3 years. And Jefferson, without Joseph's permission, changed his will, leaving his property to his wife and child. In November, Pierce was elected president, and as a reward for his campaigning, Davis became Pierce's Secretary of War. The couple were in Washington City by the spring of 1853. It was then that Verena befriended the First Lady, Jane Appleton Pierce. Socially, and to a degree physically, an invalid, Verena spent a great deal of time with the unhappy First Lady, who had actually prayed that her husband would be defeated in the 1852 election. Verena, now the wife of a cabinet official, had to entertain, and so she did. Each of the then 62 senators and 234 congressmen were, at one time or another, invited to their home on 13th Street. Mastering Washingtonian etiquette, and thanks to her wit and personality, she became quite the renowned Washington City hostess. She thoroughly enjoyed New York Senator William Seward. She became acquainted with Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner, naturalist Louis Agassiz, and director of the Smithsonian Joseph Henry. She loved her role, but also admitted to her mother that while being flattered and courted, she sometimes longed for a little down-home bluntness. In the spring of 1854, reality reared its head for Jefferson, and Verena's son, Sam, came down with measles. It took his life the 13th of June, only a few weeks before his second birthday. The disastrous blow was softened somewhat the following February when Margaret Howell Davis was born. Named for Verena's mother, Maggie, immediately became Daddy's girl. The daughter brought the two closer. Though Jefferson still called the shots and controlled the marriage with her acquiescence, the two thrived in their relationship. Yet to counter all the compromising she had to practice in the relationship, having friends and engaging guests became paramount. She enjoyed dialogue with authors Washington Irving and Nathaniel Hawthorne, and female friends like, in particular, Mary Minna Blair. In 1857, Jefferson returned to the Senate. And in Washington City in January of that same year, Verena gave birth to another son, Jefferson Jr. His birth nearly killed her. Puerperal fever. While battling for her life, both former President of the United States Franklin Pierce and current Chief Executive James Buchanan visited her. Once during her illness, in deep snow, Senator Seward sent his own sleigh to bring her assistance. After her recovery, Verena returned to her hostess duties. Her resilience was remarkable. Virginian Mrs. Roger Pryor called her one of the most cultivated women of her time, greatly sought by cultivated men and women. And indeed, she was cultivated. She demonstrated great wit and was a wonderful conversationalist. Verena also did not suffer fools gladly. Once, after a guest at her table, Lieutenant General Winfield Scott, a man who often fussed and feuded with her husband while he had been Secretary of War, commented negatively about the soup that was served, she sweetly informed him that it had been prepared by his own chef, whom she had hired for the evening. That story and incident went around the Washington City social scene, and that did not endear her to the general-in-chief. Back to her marriage. Though there were fears about a reoccurrence of the puerperal fever, Verena gave birth to yet another son in mid-April of 1859. He was named Joseph Evan Davis, after Jefferson's brother. The choice of name did not sit well with Verena, but the act signaled that the feuding brothers had resolved their differences. By now, Verena had resigned herself to two things in her marriage: long periods of separation, and Jefferson's wishes were not to be questioned. As the year 1860 neared, sectionalism further divided the nation, but Verena continued to be comfortable entertaining guests from both North and South. That being said, she did have trouble with Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner, whom she described as handsome but unpleasing. In October of 1860, she penned a letter to the former First Lady Jane Pierce. In that correspondence, she feared what was to come, expressed her love of the Union, did display racial prejudice, and expressed a willingness to consider secession and war, but dearly hoped all might be resolved without conflict. As to the coming election, she was afraid that should Abraham Lincoln be elected, the country would be buried under, as she put it, Negrodom. If he was elected and emancipation became a possibility, then she thought armed resistance might be prudent. As we all know, Lincoln was indeed elected. Her husband voted for Kentuckian John C. Breckinridge, a Southern Democrat. With the election result, she wrote, "Everybody is scared." A tie to both the Lincolns and Davises, a free black woman by the name of Elizabeth Keckley, served as a seamstress for Verena from November 1860 until January of 1861, and then for much of Mary Todd Lincoln's time in Washington City. While in the service of Verena Davis, Keckley made several observations during this turbulent time. For example, Keckley noted, "Fearing war, Verena did not want to go south for, as she put it, trouble and deprivation. But she did believe the South would win any conflict, and she would become the First Lady of the reunited United States." In truth, Keckley's observations do not jive with other letters and sources. From others, we do believe that Verena held quite a number of misgivings about secession and war, in part because of her own personal past, which included so many Northerners. Her tutor, her Philadelphia schooling, and time spent in Washington City, where she made friends from all parts of the country. Then came an event which forced her hand, head, and heart. Her husband resigned his Senate seat on January the 21st, 1861. She was in the gallery when he made his farewell speech. Reacting to his oration, she believed he was ripe for martyrdom. Soon thereafter, Jefferson was named Commander-in-Chief of Mississippi State Forces, and so the two returned to the Magnolia State. Despite the position, rumors flew that he was being considered for president of the newly created Confederate States of America. After close friendships and conversations with previous first ladies, Verena was very aware of the potential stress and loneliness that came with being the wife of a president. What can we surmise about her feelings about sectionalism, conflict, and the issue of racism? We know she had many personal ties with several in the North. We know she loved Washington City and did not want to leave. While she fervently hoped for compromise, we also know she believed in states' rights. A state had the constitutional right to leave the Union. She did support slavery and denounced abolitionists. Though in 1852 she admitted that blacks were indeed human beings, she did not support emancipation. In many respects, she was, like the nation, a torn woman with both pro-Northern and pro-Southern sentiments. If she could have voted in the election of 1860, she would have probably voted for the Constitutional Union compromise candidate, John Bell of Tennessee. In fact, the majority of voters in Natchez, Mississippi, did indeed vote for Bell, for they knew they had much to lose if secession soured, if war came and they lost. quite honestly, she accepted the fact, like almost all women in Washington City, that her husband would dictate her fate. As one woman there put it, "My husband is my country." Back at Briarfield, she and Jefferson were tending the Rose Garden one morning when a courier arrived. It was February 9, 1861. Filled with mixed emotions, he learned he had been selected provisional president of the Confederate States of America. Though filled with misgivings, his sense of duty prevailed, and off he headed for the then Confederate capital. He arrived in Montgomery, Alabama, February the 18th, and in the final days of that month, Verena left to join him in the capital city of some 9,000. 2 weeks before her arrival, secessionist William L. Yancey introduced him to enthusiastic crowds. Though Yancey proclaimed, "The man and the hour have met," Davis was all too aware of the massive tasks and challenges that lay ahead, and wrote her, "Upon my weary heart was showered smiles, plaudits, and flowers, but beyond them I saw troubles and thorns innumerable." Verena returned to Briarfield to collect furniture and the children while her husband put together his cabinet. Then, in May, the Confederate capital was moved to Richmond, Virginia, a city of 40,000 whose population quickly jumped to 140,000. On June the 1st, she and her three children arrived. Jefferson met her at the train station, and together, in a carriage, they moved through streets crowded with enthusiastic crowds. At the Spotswood Hotel, a suite awaited. There, at the hotel, bouquets arrived. So did serenades and some 15 to 20 callers each evening. She confided to her mother that she found the attention exhausting. July brought the Battle of Manassas, and 10 wives of Confederate officers lingered with her, hoping for any news about their loved ones who were on the battlefield. In fact, she had to tell the wife of Colonel Francis Bartow that he had been killed. Her duties as First Lady consumed her. In August came yet another move to the intersection of Clay and 12th Streets, the 6th residence in as many months. Leased by the Confederate government, the so-called Confederate White House was 3 stories tall. It had high ceilings, wide hallways, and furnishings in Rocco Revival style. Public functions were held on the first floor, the family lived on the second, and the third was reserved for staff. She was expected to entertain year-round. Unlike Washington City, Richmond's 300 were quite clannish, quite provincial. In short, the Tidewater Virginians gave the Davis what was called an English welcome. Cool, aloof. Status there was based upon blood and marriage, not education, wit, or even wealth. To illustrate, one preeminent Richmond hostess, Martha Pierce Stannard, boasted she had not read one book in her whole adult life. Verena learned quickly that she was expected to follow planter class values. Sized up by those Tidewater Virginians, she was described as handsome, not pretty. And as one politician put it, a good-looking lady with plenty of flesh and blood. Verena did employ a seamstress. She favored rich fabrics and solid color. And analyzed by Richmond society, it was said she dressed plainly but well. Her olive complexion prompted talk. She was too tall, 5'6", 7, or 8. She towered over South Carolinian Mary Boykin Chestnut, who was only 5 feet tall. To put it another way, Verena was about the same height as P.G.T. Beauregard and Vice President Alexander Stevens. Talk also circulated that she was too smart, too well-read, and too blunt. Her friend Constance Carey described her as a warm heart and impetuous tongue. Some thought her crude, brilliant, but unrefined. There were those who thought she made jokes for the wrong reasons. Often her faults were explained away by the fact that she came from the Cotton States. Nouveau riche. Then there were questions about her devotion to the cause. Her gift of an infant dress to Minna Blair, still in Washington City, and acceptance of her reply were talk of the town. Then there was, in the summer of 1861, a visit from a Philadelphia Howell to the Confederate White House. Indeed, it was risky business for a suspicious Richmond, which arrested, imprisoned, and seized property from Union sympathizers. Despite the founded and unfounded talk, Verena continued to host luncheons, receptions, and dinners, ran the household staff of some 20 men and women, and was also mother to 6-year-old Maggie, 4-year-old Jeff, and the youngest, Joe. What free time she had was spent reading, doing needlepoint, and taking rides around town in her carriage. And soon to join all, on December the 1st, 1861, there was another child, William Howell Davis, named after her father, who was now a naval agent for the Confederacy down in New Orleans. On the 22nd of February, 1862, Jefferson was formally inaugurated as President of the Confederacy. As he took the oath of office, her doubts swelled, thinking him, as she put it, a willing victim going to his funeral pyre. That thought so moved her that in the middle of his speech, she made an excuse and left the ceremony to return to their residence. With that act, she may be one of the only women in America who left in the middle of her husband's inauguration. Indeed, she may be the only one. Her habit of maintaining contact with Northern friends continued into 1862. More letters were smuggled north and south. We have no evidence whatsoever that she leaked any kind of information, but while in correspondence, she made a conscientious effort to conform to her role as First Lady. No matter, the rumors and criticism continued. One Confederate quartermaster by the name of Abraham Myers took note of Verena's very dark complexion and went so far as to call her a squaw. Another Virginian took issue with the fact she called her husband by his first name. Another thought she slighted all South Carolinians, despite the fact that one of her confidants was South Carolinian Mary Boykin Chestnut. As time in the war progressed, there would be those who would take great issue with Davis's presidential leadership. And when they attacked Jefferson, so too they often included Verena. That list eventually included Vice President Alexander Stevens, Generals Joseph E. Johnston, his wife Lydia, and P.G.T. Beauregard. The roll call of detractors eventually included politicians, Confederate Senator Lewis T. Wigfall and his wife Charlotte, Alabaman William L. Yancey, and South Carolina's Robert Barnwell Rhett. And needless to say, if they fell out with Jefferson and Verena, the disdain was returned. Criticized about her height, weight, dress, and manners, Verena quite honestly held up to the criticism far better than her northern counterpart, Mary Todd Lincoln. Though she visited hospitals, distributed goods, wrote letters, gathered supplies, and added those who sought her to be a liaison between them and the Confederate president, there were those who accused Verena of nepotism, harboring spies, being too friendly with Northerners, feasting when others starved, reveling in extravagance, and meddling with her husband's decisions. Verena spoke her mind, but unlike Lincoln's first lady, tantrums and anger rarely led to hysterics. Beyond her role as First Lady, as wife to Jefferson Davis, she served as an unofficial secretary and often insulated him. No question, criticism for both was dictated by the fortune or misfortune of war. Bad news affected her. With the fall of New Orleans on the 25th of April, 1862, a very depressed Verena Howell Davis wrote, "The dreadful way of living from hour to hour depresses me more than I can say." And then when George McClellan's Peninsula campaign closed in on Richmond, she wrote on the 27th of April, that same year, "How I wish I were the wife of a dry goods clerk." When the Union Army in that campaign was only some 5 or 6 miles east of Richmond, the president sent Verena and the children south to Raleigh, North Carolina. That action fueled another wave of criticism. To many, she had abandoned Richmond. They left for North Carolina's capital city May the 10th with $12,000 in Confederate money. Knowing full well that Jefferson and she would be blasted by the move, she was actually relieved to get out of Richmond for a while. She had to remind herself from history, from past conversations and relationships, the role of First Lady was a most difficult one. Abigail Adams was harshly criticized for supposedly dominating her husband, John Adams. Dolly Madison, the wife of the fourth president of the United States, was attacked for being too flirtatious and crude because she used snuff. According to her detractors, James Monroe's wife, Elizabeth, was too haughty. Louisa Adams, the wife of John Quincy Adams, was criticized for being too partisan, too opinionated. And then Sarah Childress Polk was attacked for her looks. Margaret Taylor was attacked for being too Western. No question, spring of 1862 was a trying time. In June, their home, Briarfield, was captured by Union forces, and Brother Joseph's Hurricane Plantation was torched. The loss of personal belongings, letters, and souvenirs brought anguish. During the stretch of time, we know little about the two as man and wife. In fact, the war years are the most undocumented period of their marriage. That, despite they were together for most of the time. Neither kept a diary. We don't know if Jefferson knew she communicated with Northern folk. We don't know if he chastised her for leaving the inauguration. We don't know if he talked about her lukewarmness toward the Confederacy. We do know that in spring, the couple had yet another setback. William Jackson, the president's coachman, escaped to Union lines in April, and after being interviewed by Union officers and Secretary of War Edwin Stanton himself, gave an interview to the New York Tribune. That interview made page one of the May 12th edition. Its content was picked up by other Northern papers. Jackson described President Davis as sickly and irritable. Verena was, as he put it, a scold and a devil to the household staff. A second interview followed 12 days later. The Confederate president, according to him, was ill and depressed. Verena was given to blurting whatever was on her mind, and after the fall of New Orleans was pessimistic and stopped caring about the war's outcome. Jackson related that she had told a friend she wanted to escape to Europe. Yes, much was inaccurate, but Jackson's account of her concerns about the Confederacy were pretty much on target. Though Lee drove McClellan away from Richmond by July of 1862, Verena still had a recurring dream. She and Jefferson bidding farewell in front of a laughing crowd. July found her pessimistic about the Confederacy's ability to wage war. She believed the North simply had too many resources. Its, as she put it, habits of discipline and perseverance would make the North invincible. Her realism even stretched to the point that after the war, to support the family, she would, if necessary, take a paying job. Verena and the children returned from Raleigh in October of 1862. Back in the Confederate capital, she returned to her public duties. And that, controversial as it was, included the visit of Union prisoners of war held in a Catholic hospital in Richmond. There she brought tobacco, soap, razors, and small gifts. She asked the nuns not to report her visits. We don't know if Jefferson was aware of any of these visits. Critics did not learn of this impropriety, but criticized her for insufficient visits to Richmond's 20-odd Confederate hospitals. For the record, she did visit them, and frequently brought food and supplies. In December of 1862, the president began a Western tour. From letters, we know that after Lee's victory at Fredericksburg, she urged her husband to look forward to peace and promised to love him even if he did not succeed. Spring of 1863 brought a personal setback. Her father died while she was en route to see him in Montgomery. Overwhelmed with grief, her mother's presence was calming. When she returned from her father's funeral, it was April the 2nd, 1863, the same day Richmond was terrorized by the so-called Bread Riot, led by desperate women fed up with wartime inflation and price gouging. Jefferson Davis, at the risk of injury, moved into the mob and helped to disperse it. The despair was such among the have-nots of Richmond that there was even an attempted arson of the executive mansion. Despite all this, the war had not yet forced the Davis family to cut corners. Verena had new dresses, writing paper, books, coffee, even pineapple smuggled in from Bermuda. All that drew ire, but it all changed rather quickly after Confederate defeats at Gettysburg and Vicksburg. Now, Verena had to make her gloves from her husband's old suits. Now, there was a strict adherence to a budget. And those military reversals brought new woes, both politically and personally. The wife of General Joseph E. Johnston, Lydia, blasted both the president and Verena. According to her, Jefferson was ruining her husband's career, and Verena, as First Lady, was an accomplice. Charlotte Wigfall, the wife of the Confederate senator from Texas, joined the fray. All this weighed heavily on Verena, who continued her duties as First Lady of a Confederacy that she was not sure would survive. The winter of 1864 brought word that two more slaves from the Davis household had reached federal lines, James and Betsy Dennison. Both had been in the service of the Davis family for years. They took $80 in gold and $2,000 in Confederate cash. Both the New York Herald and Chicago Tribune interviewed James. Those interviews portrayed a Verena who pined for, as he, James, put it, those good old days in Washington City, and revealed that she believed the Confederate cause was, again in his words, hopeless. Continuing, the president's temper was described as violent. He threw chairs and snapped at family members. The two did not respond. Neither wanted to draw attention or give credence to the attacks, but one must wonder about the accuracy of Verena's feelings about the Confederacy's future. And then, in the spring of 1864, tragedy to the Confederate White House. Much like the executive mansion in Washington back in February of 1862. It was April the 30th, and Verena had taken her husband's lunch to his working office at the Customs House. 5-year-old Joseph was playing on the piazza just outside the servant quarters. He climbed up on the railings and, losing his balance, fell heavily to the brick pavement below. When the frantic parents reached him, he was still breathing, but 45 minutes later, their youngest child died from a fractured skull. Both were devastated. With the loss, a wave of understandable sympathy washed over Richmond, and a huge crowd gathered May 1st for their son's burial in Richmond's Hollywood Cemetery. Joseph's death and the subsequent Grant-led Union drive toward Richmond and ultimately to Petersburg drove Arena to an outright longing for peace. The diarist Mary Boykin Chestnut described Verena as utterly depressed. Verena resigned herself to believe it was all in God's hands. Exhausted, she told her mother, "It is my only comfort to sit alone." And yet, a June 27th event brought some happiness. Verena Ann Winnie Davis was born. With her son's death, Verena lavished love on the new child. Her closest companions in Richmond were her mother and sister, who by now lived with her in the Richmond household. Family gave her strength. Her role as First Lady seemed empty. Still, for Christmas 1864, she collected goods and gifts for needy children in Richmond. However, even the spirit of giving did not rescue her from despondency. She mentioned that as it related to her role as First Lady, she said people by now didn't bother to snub or criticize her, for she thought herself a dead or dying lion, not worth kicking. She was now 37. Her hair was graying, and it seemed symbolic for the way the war was going. The winter of 1865 was bitterly cold. Bleak, also, was the Confederacy's chances for survival. In January, she sent a letter to her friend in Washington City, Eliza Gist Blair, wife of Northern journalist Francis Preston Blair. She did so even though a November 1864 Confederate Act made communicating with the enemy a treasonable offense. In the letter, she called her last 4 years the weariest and most trying of her life. By March of 65, she prepared for the worst. She packed certain goods and auctioned off other personal items for cash. $28,000 in Confederate currency was converted to gold. The president pressed her and the children to leave Richmond. With $2,000 in gold, a revolver, and some books, she agreed, and off they trained for Charlotte, North Carolina. From there, they were to move to the Florida coast, board a vessel, and travel to another country. Jefferson planned to escape to Texas, where he would continue to resist. Verena and her children left the night of March the 30th. When they arrived in Charlotte a few days later, a crowd of Confederate deserters recognized them and reviled her in shocking language. And fearing retaliation by Union authorities, no one stepped forward to give the party shelter. So they literally had to go door to door to find refuge. From Charlotte, the party headed further south and met up with the Chestnuts down in Chester, South Carolina. It was a quick reunion. Through driving rain and mud, they continued south. In Abbeville, South Carolina, she learned of Lincoln's death. As she put it, she felt wretched about it. She also learned, since federal authorities thought Jefferson was a part of the plot, a $100,000 reward had been placed on his head. From Abbeville, the party left by wagon to and through Washington, Georgia. By now, Verena used an alias, Mrs. Smith. The party included herself, her children, sister Margaret, brother Jeffy D., the children's caretaker, Ellen Barnes, a small Negro lad by the name of James Limber, whom she had taken in from the streets of Richmond, and a few soldiers. Her children held up well, considering the constant running, 6 weeks of it stretching over 500 miles. Her husband finally joined her. Not far from the Florida border, they camped in a piney wooded area just beside the roadway. 15 adults, 5 children. During the night of May 9th, 10th, federal cavalry from the 4th Michigan encircled the party and moved in at dawn. Though he did not want to, the Confederate president tried to escape. In an effort to disguise him, Verena threw a raincoat around him and draped a shawl over his head. The hastily conceived plan was for he and Ellen Barnes to head for the woods. And Verena, seeing them, would shout, "For God's sake, don't refuse me, Ellen!" However, a soldier asked the two to identify themselves, and while doing so, spotted Boots. Jefferson Davis, his wife, his children. The entire party was captured May 10th, 1865, near Irwinville, Georgia. A soldier aimed his carbine at Davis and Verena, racing to him, threw her arms around her husband. He was composed. Verena, the rest of the women, and all the children sobbed. The capture, of course, became a propagandist dream. Word circulated that Davis tried to flee disguised as a woman. Cartoons were labeled Jeff Davis in petticoats. In wagons, the captured were taken to Savannah, Georgia. On the way, in Macon, there were taunts and vicious barbs. One Union soldier shouted, "Hey, Johnny Reb, we got your president." And a Confederate spat back in reference to an assassinated Abraham Lincoln, "And the devil's got yours." In Savannah, crowds gathered to see the former First Lady of the fallen Confederacy. Some were sympathetic. Some jeered. The capture boarded the steamer William P. Clyde, and the journey northward began to Port Royal, South Carolina, and then Hampton Roads, Virginia. It was there, in Hampton Roads, the two were separated. Jefferson was to be incarcerated at Fort Monroe awaiting trial for treason. She wanted to accompany him, but the request was denied. As they bid farewell, he repeated to her that he had nothing to do with Lincoln's death. Then began their forced separation, the first in some 20 years. The decision was made to return Verena and her children to Savannah. Before they departed, two white women in garish dress and with cheeks layered in rouge arrived. Believing treasonous documents were held by Verena and members of her party, the commander of Fort Monroe, Brigadier General Nelson Miles, ordered the two heavily made-up women to strip search Verena, her mother, and Mrs. Clement Clay. They did so while one of Miles' aides and several guards stood by. Denied access to her husband, Verena required opiates for a week after the experience. Back in Savannah, she was confined to house arrest at the Pulaski House while officials decided what charges might be levied against her. Crowds gawked at the house, Verena, and her family. Her children was verbally victimized by federal soldiers. To rid of such incidents, she was given permission to send her sister and three oldest children to Montreal. By the end of the summer, she and Winnie were relocated to Augusta. She could not leave the state, but finally was allowed to communicate. Apart from all she held dear, she was often found seated, staring into space. Shackled to the fate of a defeated nation and cause that she was lukewarm about throughout the war, she passed time by reading and devouring newspapers. In desperation, she did begin a letter-writing campaign to relieve the plight of her husband. She wrote to the powerful Blair family in Washington City and to editor Horace Greeley in New York City. There were visits to President Andrew Johnson. Eventually, she was allowed to stay at Jefferson Davis's living tomb in Fort Monroe. As time passed, her husband's judicial purgatory evoked sympathy. It spread across the Atlantic, as evidenced by an act from Pope Pius IX, who in sympathy sent Davis a crown of thorns. Finally, in February of 1869, his charge of treason was dismissed. For Verena, the first and only First Lady of the Confederacy, reunion with her husband brought mixed blessings, for there would be more trials, personal and professional. Some that lingered from the past, some present, and some from what the future held for her. Jefferson died in December of 1889 at the age of 81. She was 63. And by the time of her husband's death, had lost two more of her children. Son William had died of diphtheria 17 years earlier. Her son, Jeff Jr., had died of yellow fever in October of 1878. Margaret survived and would be the only child to marry and have heirs. And yet, Winnie, the so-called daughter of the Confederacy, passed in September of 1898 at the young age of 33, the fifth of her children she had to bury. Despite the wave after wave of misfortune and heartbreak, she pressed on, even in the wake of unflattering post-war memoirs. Though there had been trying times with her husband, when Confederate officials in their post-war writings attacked Jefferson, she fought back. And when called upon by those who embraced the lost cause, she responded. At some point, however, she wanted to break free from the past, and so moved to New York City, where, living at a hotel on Park Row, she took up pen. Of course, there were those who criticized her for moving to New York, for abandoning the South. Yet around the turn of the 20th century, she became to many our Southern Queen. While in the city, she became an open advocate of regional reconciliation. It was there she met Julia Dent Grant, the widow of Ulysses S. Grant, and the two women became friends. They had a good deal in common and genuinely liked one another. Their friendship was celebrated in much of the national press, although it was ignored by most conservative white Southerners. Verena attended reunions of veterans from both armies, and she was a member of both the Daughters of the American Revolution and the United Daughters of the Confederacy. In 1901, she met the African-American leader Booker T. Washington in New York, and they had a brief civil conversation. That same year, in an article in the New York World, she proclaimed that God, in his wisdom, had allowed the North to prevail and the United States to survive. In essence, stating now in public what she had said privately back in 1862. Verena enjoyed her senior years in the big city. She hosted visitors, wrote letters, read books, went to the theater, and enjoyed daily rides in her carriage through Central Park. In the fall of 1906, she decided to move from one hotel to another, the Majestic Hotel overlooking Central Park. In doing so, she contracted pneumonia. It turned worse and took her life at 10:30 p.m. on the 16th of October, 1906. When Verena passed at the age of 80, the Vanderbilts, Roosevelts, and Mary Custis Lee all responded. The son of U.S. Grant, General Frederick Dent Grant, sent an artillery escort for her funeral. That military funeral was held in Richmond on the 19th, 45 years after she first came to the then Confederate capital. During her lifetime, her critics thought her vain, proud, sarcastic, ill-tempered, biased to her husband, and one who ran a court in Richmond and New York City. Yes, though there were times she suffered from her own impetuosity and all-too-ready tongue, the fact is, Verena Howell Davis was intelligent, influential, stately, devoted, warm-hearted, and quite spontaneous. She inherited and became party to extraordinary circumstances, and consequences of those conditions often came back to assail her. By fate, she became the first lady of a failed nation, and perhaps in a way, died a little herself when the Confederacy came crashing down. She was laid to rest with her husband and their children in Richmond's Hollywood Cemetery. There, overlooking the James River, her marker reads with what she desperately desired for most of her life. The inscription reads simply, at peace. With gray cape lined with red satin and ostrich plume in hat, he was the beau ideal of the Cavalier South. He was Lee's trusted eyes and ears. When next we gather, we'll mount up with Jeb Stuart as we follow his remarkable exploits and pay particular attention to the summer of 1863, when many believe he failed his comrades and the commander he dearly loved. Next up, Joshua Ewell Brown, Jeb Stuart. This is Fred Kiger. Thank you for listening.
This podcast is sponsored by The Badge Maker, your go-to source for American Civil War Corps badges and other handmade, American-made historical reproductions. Contact the proprietor, Joseph Valicenti, and place your orders at www.civilwarcorpsbadges.com. That's www.civilwarcorpsbadges.com. This podcast is sponsored by Bob Grasser, Raleigh Civil War Roundtable's editor of the Knapsack Newsletter, and the Roundtable's webmaster at RaleighCWRT.org. That's RaleighCWRT.org.